Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're exploring interactions from drug studies in a laboratory.
If this effect is as big as he's saying, somebody should have discovered this long before he did.
To global wisdom on avoiding hangovers.
Beber cerveza antes de tomar vino no previene los síntomas.
Bière sur vin et venant, vin sur bière et belle manière.
Beer before wine, you're going to be fine. Wine before beer, you're going to be queer.
To the novel recipes developed by an Indian American family deep in the heart of Texas.
And then my mom's sort of coming to America and learning that white parents love to melt cheese on things to get their kids to eat it. She was like, this is genius.
Be sure to subscribe to Meat in Three. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome, welcome. This is Why Food Podcast on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your co-host, Jenny Dorsey, and Ethan is unfortunately not with us today because he's on a scouting trip in Zanzibar, but we promise he'll be back next week with excellent stories to tell us about his time away. But today, I'm super excited to welcome Will Horowitz to the studio. He is the co-founder of two amazing restaurants here in New York, Duck's Eatery, as well as Harriet and Ida's Meat and Supply Company, I got that right, as well as a recent co-author of the book, Salt Smoke Time, which came out a few weeks ago. Will, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. It's wonderful being here.
Well, I'll jump right into the book first since it's top of mind. Can you tell us a little bit about the book, inspiration behind the book, and also who you co-authored it with?
Sure. I wrote the book mainly with my sister, who also did the illustrations, which are gorgeous, gorgeous. And you know, this book was kind of a long time coming. I pushed off kind of doing the author thing for a while. And I wanted to really create a book less around recipes and more just around what I'm thinking right now, how I'm cooking, what my view is on the food system at large and sustainability. And so much of that for us involves nature. And involves heritage cooking and fermentation and smoking. And Julie, my sister, did incredible, like I said, illustrations for field guides for foraging inside there. And it's really a book on how can nature and our past inspire us to create more sustainable systems, and whether that be for our own cupboard and kitchen and the way we live to possibly even as communities and larger.
A lot of your ethos is around foraging, being able to, you know, be in sync with nature, being able to kind of bring back heritage foods. Can you talk about where you got a lot of that inspiration from? You went to a certain school in Colorado, and kind of like how that mentality has developed as you've also opened restaurants on your own.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, for me, it's you know, these things are really kind of very intimate to my own story. My grandparents on my father's side owned a Jewish delicatessen in Harlem where they were pickling, fermenting everything, curing their, you know, tongues and corned beefs out on the fire escape out back up in Harlem and then the Bronx. And on my mother's side, my family is from Orient and Greenport in the North Fork of Long Island, which to people that don't know are kind of an old sort of colonial, still very working class fishing towns. And my grandfather was a fisherman and just avid kind of bayman. And my grandmother was a French trained chef.
Oh, wow.
So we had a lot of heritage in our family for sure from, you know, like I said, you know, pickling and smoking pastrami's and tongues and sauerkrauts to, you know, massive, you know, lobster and clam bakes out on the beach every year and working with seaweed and clams and really everything that the bay out there has to offer. And then as I started growing up, a lot of my focus became in primitive survival.
Okay.
And just studying a lot of First Nation groups and techniques and homesteading. And I went to, like you mentioned, the weird school I went to was...
I didn't say weird.
is Naropa University in Boulder, Colorado. And I was specifically there originally for the writing program, which is the Jack Kerouac Institute of Disembodied Poetics, or at least then it was. And so that was nice for me to write this because I started off as a writer. I just had to cook for
a couple decades
to get someone to publish my writing. But what I ended up going into there was Buddhism and mainly permaculture. And permaculture is kind of the art of setting up symbiotic farm systems and homesteading systems that really work for themselves. So the idea of planting trees, you know, in a place where, you might want to grow things that don't really need as much light, to inoculating soils that might work as better composters for that land, to growing low brush, and really just controlling water and in ecosystems and inspiring a piece of land to grow for itself and to create more topsoil. So there's a joke of permaculture to me, which is, how do we create a farm where if we go on vacation for a few weeks, it'll only actually get better without us there messing it up. And that's kind of really exemplifies these exact systems. And what I've done in cooking and food and everything else is I've tried to take those same lessons and apply it to so much more than just agriculture systems.
And just about the topsoil that you mentioned, we talked a little bit about this at lunch, but can you kind of explain like why topsoil is so important to a farm, what it is, like what people are trying to constantly preserve about it?
Well, I think, from a food system level, you're talking about a lot of nutrients that you're getting. So right now, one of the problems with a lot of factory farming, industrialized farming, is that there's no nutrients in anything. Or at least it's like the Wonder Bread situation. We're adding it back in to the land. We've taken it out and we're adding it back in.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of creating systems that are actually going to grow, or at least build more topsoil is that we're creating just so much more fertile farmlands. And the same problems that we had, back in the 20s and 30s with the Dust Bowls and stuff like that in the West is because we just kept taking from land. And really, the only system that works are ones that you can figure out that are going to be healthy enough to do quite the opposite. They're going to give to the land. And that works only if you're doing something that creates topsoil.
So after going to school and studying kind of like this holistic view on agriculture, what inspired you to go and start restaurants? Is that kind of the first stance of changing how this works?
No, it was more by mistake, to be honest. I got out of Naropa and honestly, I was a ski bum at the time living in Colorado. And I was, really had a backpack half on every day and just traveling around and hitching around where I could and staying, in the woods as much as I could. And cooking for me was something I'd always done. It was something I did with my family, my grandparents. It was, always the go-to job when I was growing up.
Yeah.
It was something you could do at night so you could still enjoy your day.
And so, that's true.
And so, what really was something that I did as survival was something that I grew more and more in love with. And as I went down that road, I became more and more successful at it as a chef. And just better at the trade of working in a line and just making food and hopefully creating good food. And that to me was an art form and something that spoke to me really well. And as I kept getting more and more proficient, like anything, you start, allowing your other passions to kind of create more of a free for all within that discipline. And now, circa 14, 15 years from there, I've kind of really taken that circle back into the sustainability stuff that I started with. And so it's been really, really a very fun trip.
And when you first started Ducks, which is going on, you said, 8-9 years?
Yeah, about 8 years.
A lot of it was centered around meat, and it's kind of like moving potentially in a different direction. Can you talk a little bit about kind of the early successes around what techniques that you were doing there and how that's translated over time.
Yeah, so, you know, a big part of my focus is around smoking foods and, like I said, fermenting foods and really just creating foods the long, often longer way and older way. And one of the reasons we did that is because that was from backpacking and camping and primitive survival and my family, that was near and dear to me. But also because if anyone's ever been in Doxedri, the kitchen is about the size of a normal bathroom stall in most restaurants. And we were doing enormous amount of covers. And so in order for us to do that and do that in a way that we really felt great about what we were doing and the food we were putting out, we had to create these systems where everything was either slow cooked, brined, cured, fermented, whatever it was, smoked for days on end, sometimes weeks on end, sometimes years on end, or it was still wiggling around fresh a lot. So there was you know, only two ways about it. There wasn't a lot of room for a lot of multi-step dishes, you know, while you're on the line. And that was the way we can still create food that had incredible depth of flavor to it. And the other thing that we, you know, was an issue at Ducks in the beginning, and a small restaurant I think is always going to be, is money. And so, you know, trying to open up a small restaurant without any money is difficult as it is. And at the same time, we didn't want that to sacrifice the food either. Mm-hmm. So we started looking towards our farmers and butchers for offcuts and things that we can still get inexpensively, but from good farmers and good people. So one of the first dishes that we became really famous for there was a smoked goat's neck, which kind of rotates between a goat and a lamb. And it was because we had a butcher that had too many of them. It was that simple.
And people would never order that otherwise.
People would never order that. But, I mean, I'll be honest, this is 8 years later, it's the only thing that stays on the menu. And I think yesterday we filmed something for as mainstream as a channel as Barstool Sports, serving goat's neck and smoked eel to a bunch of linebackers.
Really?
And so, and for me, I'm more than happy to do that. I mean, the reason the goat neck was so famous originally because it was on Guy Fieri.
Yeah.
And I have it was Flavor Town. And I have zero pride in saying that. But to be honest, when we first got that call years ago, I was going out to my partners I think my co-chef was outside smoking a cigarette at Ducks, and I was going out there to just laugh a little bit and say, I think I was like, hey, let's think of really fun ways to tell Guy Fieri to go fuck himself. and he looked at me like I was the biggest idiot in the world, because I was the biggest idiot in the world, because you can't responsibly turn things like that down in small businesses. And the truth of the matter is, and what I've learned 8 years later, maybe not more mature, but I've just somehow it's been ingrained into me, is that those things really help. And if I'm using offcuts and I'm using these weird things, I'm either going to cook it for myself or I'm cooking it for everyone else. And there's mm-hmm. no two ways about it. So if I'm cooking it for everyone else, I want to be able to make sure that that becomes as accessible mm-hmm. as possible. And I want to make that more of a household name. I want to make goat necks more of a household name until it's not sustainable. And trust me, we almost got there. At a certain point, after so many hundred goat necks, you're kind of picturing this, like, you know, Gary Larson Far Side cartoon of a bunch of, like, necklace goats laying around. So, you know, we might have danced around that line a bit, but that's the idea, is how do you make these things accessible? It doesn't mean you have to compromise making something really fucking cool or interesting as a chef. I have no problem serving some of the same things I've served to, you know, an Instagram account like Barstool or anything like that. I have no problem serving something to them that aren't known for as much interesting food and stuff as I do serving it to any top chef or critic in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because it's not just interesting. It just tastes really fucking good. And that's at the heart of all these techniques and using offcuts. So we started, sorry, it's a long circle around to the original question. We started doing these techniques to meats because it was so obvious.
Yep.
We've done that for a long time. It was interesting. And now we're doing it more to vegetables.
Yeah, so talk about that. Like, talk about this radish charcuterie that you entered in a competition, or some of the carrot hot dogs.
And we started doing this stuff a few years ago, and we started, you know, we had so much experience in just, you know, making our own bacons and hams and all this type of stuff and salumis. We just simply applied a lot of those old school methods to a lot of vegetables. And, you know, for me as a chef, I think for a lot of chefs, whether they can, or in a situation where they can publicly admit it or not, you know, the alternative meat world is fucked right now. Sorry, is that right? That I curse so
yeah,
much?
Yeah. We
it's,
love
it's
it.
It's completely screwed up. Like, you're talking about, like, you know, it's in the natural food world, you know, it's we live in this crazy situation in society where the natural food world and actual real day-to-day chefs are completely separate universes. Yep. And day-to-day chefs who are the ones that have, you know, decades of incredible experience understanding about flavor and stuff are rotting away in restaurants that don't make any money. And the natural food world has half of Silicon Valley invested into it right now. So in the alternative meat world, you know, some of the two largest companies, let's say Beyond and Impossible, and Beyond is, I don't know, have taken in probably 1/4 the funding as Impossible. And they and they went public last week.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, these companies have taken in, you know, just the two of them alone, probably close to $600-700 million in the past 3-4 years.
Yeah.
And there's just some of the top two. And all these ingredients pretty much sum themselves down to hyper-processed coconut fat and pea protein, now soy protein, pretty much for all of them.
Yep.
And it's bullshit.
It's like hydrogenated into like a weird
it's
and
complete
texture.
BS. This is what we did with tofu in the 80s. We just we took this great product and we turned it into really shitty American tofu chili.
Yeah, it's so sad because good tofu is really good.
This is our mentality of doing these things. And it's nuts. And, you know, so for the work I do, I wanted to approach it differently. I wanted to create products and alternative meats that we use alternative meat because that's relatable. The real thing issue here is we wanted to turn a corner and change the conversation and make vegetables the real star of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And we still use them like meats, but they're vegetables. So we have jerkies that are made out of mushrooms or seaweed. And we have smoked... one of the great ways to start is we got drunk, smoked a watermelon last year, and we got over 120 million views for it online.
It went very viral.
We were on every morning show, everything you can imagine, and we still get requests every day. I mean, we have still to this day, it's a year later, we have production companies flying in from Russia to Japan
to
Germany, all for like one day shoots. This fucking watermelon. It's nuts.
Can you tell us what you did to the watermelon? How it tastes?
It tastes good. It's okay. It's pretty good. And we have other vegetable stuff that tastes way better, but the reason the watermelon did well because it looks like a ham. Mm-hmm. And so it got coined like that way. And in the vegetarian world, people aren't used to, there's no showstopper cuts of meat.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no celebratory roasts. There's no brisket. There's no prime rib. The closest thing we had was a tofurkey. So to see a watermelon, I mean, God bless. The one thing we've freaking done is spend millions of dollars and 50 years developing seedless watermelons. So thank you for that. But we ferment it, we smoke it, we age it, we roast it. We're able to look inside, you know, work with these vegetables or fruits to figure out what the natural components are inside of them and work with those natural components, whether it's to firm them up or build a skin or whatever it is. If a fruit has more pectin than others or anything we can do, you know, for the watermelon, we actually cure in ash.
Mm-hmm.
So we use high alkalinity to help us cure. But either way, you know, what we're excited about is that this opened up a whole new frontier for us to do whole vegetables and whole fruit. And so we're in the process of coming out with a whole line of smoked carrot dogs that actually, and that sounds ridiculous because like, oh, no shit, dummy, like a carrot, it looks kind of like a hot dog. Like, yeah, I swear we're not just putting carrots on a bun. But I mean, listen, people do sell
pet
rock
in the
80s. But listen, so And we figured out ways of doing it where if you bite into the carrot, it actually snaps like it's an encased meat.
Okay. Are you able to reveal how it's done?
All I can say is that we're not rewriting the book. We're doing ways that we've done for thousands of years on meat, but we're adapting those to vegetables. It snaps, bites, tastes like a smoked hot dog, and if you put it on a pan or grill it, even bubbles up like a sausage. And there's, you know, three ingredients into it, and one of them is salt and the other one is a carrot. So it's not rocket science. It just takes a long time. And we label things as like a watermelon ham or it's a hot dog, whatever it is. It's semantics. It's a smoked carrot. We don't expect it to taste like smoked pork, and we don't expect smoked pork to taste like smoked salmon.
Mm-hmm.
It's just opening up a new door and a new direction to whole foods, except using them and utilizing them in different ways and more, you know. And it doesn't mean we don't like raw watermelon. I still prefer a really good raw watermelon. I wasn't set out to do a anti-raw watermelon bashing, you know, campaign, but you know, we got plenty of people emailing us saying we were, so that's amazing. But you know, listen, we spent the first half of our career getting handwritten hate mail from PETA once a month, and 3 weeks ago we headlined the front page of their website,
really,
for the work we've been doing. And it's and at the same time, maybe this will ruin my good graces at the moment with them. But we have no interest in taking away meat from our menus and our life. You'll find that even statistically, with the rise of vegetarianism, the majority of people are flexitarian.
Yeah.
And I think what we're all looking for, so many people are looking for, and I could say we all, because it's relative, definitely myself is looking for, and my sister, is just more veggie forward food.
Yep.
Let's eat more vegetables. Let's make that more the star of the show. And let's still eat meat and fish, but let's eat less of it. And in doing so, let's make it even more special. Let's make it even more delicious. And not only that, but let's make even more responsible choices with it. And with that smaller amount of meat that we're consuming, allows us to create even deeper relationships to where it's from, and more healthy, sustainable choices for not just us, but the larger picture. And we can't do that with the amount we consume now.
Yeah.
You know?
I think it's a dangerous battle or that we're kind of in right now, where it feels like if you have to go extreme one way, you're totally vegan, you're kind of demonizing meat.
This is the story of the world. And, you know, it's nuts.
How do you find that balance, right?
It's so crazy. This is just the story of us all. This is with politics. This is with everything. We're such a big bunch of dummies. It's ridiculous. We always want a golden champion. We always want... This was the argument with sustainable energy back in the 90s. And, it's wind energy. No, it's hydro. No, it's everything. It's different cases have different scenarios. And it's a wide spectrum of all these different ideas and techniques. And, you know, that's what's going to get us there. You know, I think we were talking about this earlier. The past 2 years, I've been working on seaweed and sustainably farmed kelp. And that's been driven in many forms as the, you know, great savior to sustainability. And I agree. I think it's really I told you, I think it's potentially the most sustainable form of large-scale agriculture in the world. It's still going to take a lot of different things. to get us to the point we need, and there's not going to be a single answer for it.
We can't all just start eating kelp overnight and only kelp.
I mean, unless you're, you know, square bob, you can't. But yeah, it doesn't have all the nutrients we need, but it's really good, and it's a really good thing to do. And that, collaborating with smaller farms and more vegetable forward diets, and you know, I think we can get somewhere that's really inspiring.
Well, with that, we're going to take a short break and we'll be back in about 2 minutes.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast?
Heritage Radio Network has plenty more.
I'm Patrick Martins.
I'm Brandon Hoy.
And I'm Emily Pearson. Together we host The Main Course OG, where we cover food news and culture. Browse episodes of The Main Course OG wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
And welcome back to Why Food. This is your co-host, Jenny Dorsey. No Ethan today. Again, Ethan is off having fun without us, but I'm in here in the studio with Will Horowitz, who is the co-founder of Ducks Eatery and Harry and Ida's Meat and Supply Co., as well as the co-author of Salt Smoke Time. Like, afraid that I'm going to get it in the wrong order. We were just talking about kelp and how kelp is really good for us, very nutritious for us, kind of been lauded as the next superfood sort of thing. Can you tell us a little bit more about just the different types of kelp, water-based kelp, land-based algaes that we were talking about earlier, and kind of where do you think that's going?
Kelp is interesting, and obviously, you know, there's plenty of countries when you get to a lot of Asian countries that have been working with kelp for generations and generations. So, you know, Japan and Korea and China have a huge amount of kelp farms going for a long time. Not that they're all sustainable.
Sure.
But like anything. But kelp is very much a part of the future of sustainability. Some of the main reasons of it is that sustainable farmed kelp is zero input. So you don't need to feed it. You don't need to water it. It's in water. It doesn't take away, like we talked about, topsoil. It's not taking away from the environment. It's actually only adding biodiversity and ecosystems and nutrients. So, you know, for all those types of reasons, and also that it grows incredibly fast and really is low startup costs, it is, I think, internationally by, you know, chefs and farmers being donned as something less revolutionary. Like all things, I don't think it's the great savior because I don't think that word exists.
Yeah.
Some of the research I found in kelp was that, it's a superfood for whatever that means.
Yeah, unclear what exactly that means.
But it sounds great. But actually it's very low on protein and things like that. And which is, don't get me wrong, you know, a lot of things like protein and a lot of nutrition is based on fads anyway. I believe on average the CDC is put out that I think Americans get, I don't know, something like maybe 9 to 11% more protein than we can ever possibly need to survive.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, these are so much of these things are, are Valentine cards, you know, their marketing campaigns.
Because protein was seen as like the most efficient calorie. I think that was the marketing for a while.
It's pretty wild stuff. You know, I mean, that was the Atkins argument. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I could tell you, at least from a, you know, not just a family of chefs, but a father who was a chief of cardiology here at Beth Israel for 25 years. Atkins was not the way to go.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
For a man that died of a heart attack, that was not the way to go. So, you know, we're insane about these types of things. And with that being said, what does have a great amount of protein to offset things like, you know, kelp is land-based algaes, freshwater algaes like spirulina and things like that. And we're spirulina has been interesting. It's been kind of on a roller coaster ride of people investing in it and trying to figure out how that agricultural system looks like. Some of the more successful systems are equally being done in, you know, what look like, you know, land-based fish farms, like, you know, above-ground pools, essentially. It's just as much as in, you know, labs in basements of Brooklyn right now. So it's really interesting, but the amount of protein that's in those types of algaes are equal, if not more, per capita than beef.
That's crazy.
And so it's pretty amazing. So, you know, I can tell you as a chef, making a spirulina mayo, and actually, believe it or not, tastes fantastic because you're getting all this umami of the seaweed.
And it's pretty.
It's pretty. Is just, at least for this culture, is a lot easier for me to get people to accept, or even if I have to sneak into their food, than it is insects.
Which has
been such a big idea and fantastic one, but much more difficult to get people's hands.
Even if it's like ground up in flour or like in unnoticeable.
I think the proof has been in the pudding. So, you know, there's some great companies and great people doing some incredible stuff with ground up, you know, insects. But it's definitely been a struggle.
Yeah.
I can't speak to what their numbers are, but it hasn't been, you know, it's gotten a lot of waves of press, but there hasn't been a big boom of everyone going around eating insects and things like that. You know, sometimes with seaweed, you have to kind of remind people that, hey, that's what's wrapping your 7-Eleven sushi to normalize it a little bit.
Yeah.
Because pretty much that's spread to everywhere now, so at least we have that as a base.
Sure.
But, you know, it's we're still trying to figure out with seaweed. There's, you know, 50,000 plus different, you know, species of brown algae, of kelp, that are edible to begin with. So we're still trying to figure out in every climate what our soy, corn, and rices are. You know, what our main crops are going to be. And here we predominantly tend to harvest sugar kelp and horsetail kelp.
Okay.
In the Northeast. And, you know, from Connecticut, Rhode Island to Maine, there's been, you know, huge improvement in getting farmers started and switching over maybe fishing, you know, unsustainable fishing practices and businesses to kelp farms. But it's really moving slow. And last year I started co-founded a company with some partners called Akua, which is a kelp jerky that I made of kelp and mushroom stems. As I'm not as involved anymore, I'm still one of the partners of it. And so, you know, that was an interesting one for me to work on. And I definitely became very intimate with seaweed.
One of the things we also were talking about over lunch is kind of as you push companies and, you know, chefs and everyone else to be more sustainable, it also needs to work in a for-profit sort of environment. Yeah. They still have to be able to make money in order to galvanize and intrigue other organizations to enter that space. Can you kind of talk about how you think through that sort of model, or how you think how we shift into a food system where people can still be in it for their own interests, so to speak, but also for the world?
Absolutely. So, you know, that's been definitely something very near and dear to me. And watching a lot of the nonprofits work in the food systems has been extremely inspiring. And what makes sense to me is that the only food nonprofits that end up actually working long term are the ones that are going to be, at the very least, catalysts for other for-profit sustainable systems.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, you know, what we're doing as chefs and what I'm doing in the restaurant or to the carrots or to watermelons or to goat necks or any of these types of things or seaweed comes down to one basic element, which is I'm working to take something that's undervalued and I'm learning from thousands of years of the past and from nature ideas and techniques on how to create more value for it. And if I can do that, and I could afford to pay the goat farmer more for something they might have been tossing into dog food, I can make more money for my small business and restaurant, and I could do it making food that's more accessible to the communities that need it the most.
Mm-hmm.
And by taking these ideas and these old school, this old knowledge that we have of whether it's fermenting or smoking, whatever it is, just creating something that's going to create more value out of something, I can connect all three. So the struggling farmer, to the struggling restaurant, to the struggling community. And it's the only system that can lift these microeconomies and communities without having to take handouts or big boosts that are from larger corporations coming in or whatever it is. Because the thing about that, and the thing truthfully with any larger amount of money being injected fast into communities, is that you don't actually move farther away from the cliff. The cliff just gets higher.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you do drop off that cliff, it's a lot longer the way down. And when we look at places like, Detroit and stuff like that, you see very actualized examples over the years, and there's been plenty of fishing towns up the Northeast that have been just like that. It's it's not a by accident that these areas that were previously supported by larger corporations happen to now be some of the larger concentrations of opioid abuse and things like that.
And it's also challenging when you want to be sustainable, and sustainable is, in vogue right now, or I guess it's always been in vogue, but very much more in vogue now, whereas also we kind of said on lunch, it's like you don't also only want to be feeding the 1% can afford it.
And that's such a big problem. You're 100% right. And there's been so many great chefs and people have done, really publicized the use of food waste and things like that. But when you do these things and you're charging a leg for them, then it doesn't really, besides the PR value, it doesn't mean anything.
It's not a more equitable system that you're building.
Bring me the top chefs in the country and let's all get together and let's figure out ways of making this food so that it's helping the farmer and making it more accessible to the people that can't afford it. Good food and that are surviving off of fast food and cholesterol. So those are the people that need it. Those are the people that are facing, essentially a plague, and so that should be the mission right now for everybody.
Who do you think what chefs and what other organizations do you think are doing a good job of trying to actually change the system, and what can we do as a collective society who are interested but potentially, don't have tons of money to donate? Like, how can we get more plugged in?
I think, for a lot of people, it's figuring out there's all sorts of good ideas and techniques and ways to figure out how do you shop at the farmer's market in a way that's actually on a budget, that's not nominal. How do you go up to, farmers, ask for their scraps, ask for what they're, look at what's cheap and look back, whether it's at your grandparents or your buddies, and look back and figure out how to make that delicious. I think that's one of the main things everybody can do and create a skill set for. And again, so many of those answers is just looking into our own past. When it comes as a whole, there's been so many great chefs that have done so many incredible things and much more than me. I could say that over the past few years, I've been friendly with Massimo Bottura and his wife, Lara, and family. And from a couple Cook It Raw trips in Mexico and beyond. And, one of the things that was so inspiring to me about watching families like that is that once he got his, coveted number one in the world award, and, for whatever that's worth, and, as a chef, it's worth quite a bit. Unlike a lot of other chefs I saw do that, what was so inspiring is that he took that and he went down to places like Rio and, fed 10,000 people banana peel bacon or, things like that. And whether they were fantastic tasting or weren't fantastic tasting, I have no idea, I wasn't there. But either way, just to the PR of that, the campaign of that, to say, I'm not going to do this. I'm going to take this crazy amount of press and this award that I got and this, incredible accomplishment, and I'm going to go and spend the craziest year of my life running around to all these countries and trying to make byproducts and waste something that's nutritional and great to eat for people that and communities that need it the most, is to me the most inspiring thing you could possibly do as a chef. It doesn't mean that you can't also run a 3-star Michelin restaurant right. on the side or as your main focus, but to pair that and to use that fame, that incredible research you're doing, whatever it is, to use it in a way that will also help people is the best thing you could possibly do, because otherwise, what exactly is all that research for then besides your own fucking vanity?
At the end of the day, that's what
it comes down to, you know?
And so to bring this all kind of back to what we mentioned very briefly at the beginning of the podcast, what about people who might be interested in starting foraging on their own to sustain themselves a little bit? You know,
well, that's definitely doable. I definitely, you know, at the same time, I don't want to see a world where everything is completely foraged and there's literally no more nature left around cities. But at the same time, learning to forage is something that needs to be done tandem with learning with responsible and sustainable, you know, harvesting.
Yep.
And it's the same thing to me for hunting as well. I'm definitely more and more as I get older, a big advocate for conservation driven hunting and fishing.
Can you explain to us what that means?
So, you know, very, very simply, each area of land can only hold a certain amount of ecosystem. And if that ecosystem becomes unbalanced, and unfortunately so many have, and even more so, unfortunately, because of us and because of, you know, cities growth and just, you know, there's so much, you know, population is probably the largest problem facing the world, obviously.
Yeah.
And so there's less and less habitat for animals. And what happens, the same way as humans, is that breeds diseases. And you get more and more that end up dying in more massive amounts. Just because a land can't hold that, you know, percentage. And that also takes a toll on the actual fauna and what they'll eat. And then that will take a toll on something else. So. Mm-hmm. That type of overpopulation that's developed will actually crush ecosystems. So, you know, I think that for me, I'm more and more in support of harvesting wild game and animals as respectfully as possible. You know, I'm not definitely not into the bro romanticism of it. I think for farmers and hunters, anyone that kills an animal and doesn't have a emotional response and isn't sad by that deeply, I think that you shouldn't be doing it, you know? I think that that's borderline sociopathic, you know? But it doesn't mean that it shouldn't be done. And it's, you know, my real fight is against the factory farm stuff. And for sustainably foraging, it's the same thing, you know? Picking what you need and making sure that what you picked isn't going to affect next year or the year after. And, you know, I have living in the city now, I have still about, let's say, a smaller piece of land that I public land that I foraged since I was a kid. That's about 900 acres or so.
Oh, wow.
And well, compared to, you know, other places for here that's large. And I've been foraging there as a kid. I grew up mountain biking in there, so I really know every tree, every rock really, really well, and know where everything grows. And so every year it's been a learning lesson rather than some sort of profitable foraging business for me. Although my maitake season's pretty awesome. And but I get to see how things come back. I get to think, you know, but the first year I had this incredible area, and this is close to the city, so there's only so much stuff. I had this incredible right when everyone started getting into lichens and things, and that became a little crazy, and I learned how all these different history of lichens and lichens is people think that mycology is nuts. Is a
oh,
whole
are they
world
different?
To study. Lichens are very borderline with mycelium,
okay,
and actually work in tandem with mycelium, but it's always back and forth whether it's classified as mycelium.
Okay.
And they are something we don't even know the tip of the iceberg about. And so it's a whole nother world. But, you know, I learned something really great about lichen is that when when I decided I wanted to learn all about cooking with reindeer lichen, I cleared out a little patch that I knew I had somewhere. and thinking that next year I would grow back, and it didn't. And then I thought that maybe it'll take a couple years and I'll grow back. And it's been 14 years and that hasn't grown back. So that was a learning lesson to me about picking lichen.
Really?
So, you know, learn what you're doing and learn what you're picking. And for your own safety, you know, start with just a couple things. And this is the rule for foraging mushrooms or wild edibles. Start with a couple things that you can, you know, research, and you know the clear signs how not to confuse with something else. And there are just, you know, plenty of things like that. Here in the Northeast, there's probably about maybe 5 to 7 mushrooms that there's a couple clear tell signs will not look like something else. And you start there and you get comfortable, then you grow.
There's an interesting statistic, I guess, I learned when I was doing a cooking class in Spain, and that like October is their mushroom picking season. And every year there's just X like percentage of mushroom poisonings because, you know, kids go out and start picking everything. But it's, I haven't gotten sick yet.
Well, I think the saying is, I know I'm going to mess this one up, is there's old mushroom foragers and there's bold mushroom foragers, but there's no bold and old mushroom foragers.
Yes, that is true.
Mycology humor is pretty nerdy.
Yeah, I mean, when I went out with the Mycological Society, I was just like, people were really into... Mm-hmm. Then I was like, oh, wow, okay, I'm just here to try and eat all these mushrooms. But it was interesting. Also, just a nice 3 hours outside. So
yeah, really and for me, that's really the point of it. You know, is that you know, I'm a firm believer that you know, being in nature and being something larger than yourself is very important. And I love foraging, but it's really an excuse for me to get outside and be outside.
Well, Will, thank you so much for being here. Can you tell all our listeners where to find you, come eat at your restaurants, and follow, potentially buy some of your upcoming veggie hot dogs and such?
Sure, absolutely. So you could definitely come visit me at Duck's Eatery and Harry Knight's in the East Village. I cook still at Duck's Eatery a couple nights a week. Monday is my big fun chef night, so everyone come visit me. My book is Salt Smoke Time, which you could find hopefully everywhere, at least everywhere. For now. And and please, anyone feel free to reach out to me if you're along the same path and working on the same ideas.
Where can they find you online?
You can find me at online. The website. Email us. Okay. That personal thing? No, I mean, listen, follow me on Instagram. It's just Will Horowitz. It's real simple, or Duck's Eatery. And just come visit me. Don't worry about the online thing. Come say hi. Drink a beer.
Say hi in person.
Eat a goat neck.
Well, thank you again for being here. And as always, you can find us at Why Food Podcast on Instagram and Facebook. And you can send questions, comments, nominations for other people you'd like to hear on the show to whyfood@heritageradionetwork.org. Thank you to Amanda for being our sound engineer. And our theme song is Blind by the Red Crickets. See you next week. Track of time at the physical. We were face to face and back to my back. Went to a place that only I can know. That's why we... Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.